Welcome to the Emmy Louie Show. I am Emmy Louie, and are you ready to be on the edges of your seats and listen to our conversation today? I'm here with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org, and last time when we spoke about many things all tied together. It's really the big picture about climate change, peak oil, rail systems, as well as new urbanism, the concept, and how it's applied, and how that is affecting really, that's one of the many answers to the many problems that we have today on a very global and worldwide basis. And what I've come to a conclusion is that we have, in the United States, we are in a system that we are locked in that is, for lack of a better word, an evil system because of the harmful effects that it's creating on just climate change and all that. And we're going to talk more about that because education is really important, and we can't make decisions if we don't know what the decisions are. So education is really important in talking about all of these issues. And from newurbanism.org, I welcome Andy Kunz.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Thank you for being on the show, and I'm ready for another lively discussion today. I know last time when we spoke, we talked about many things. We spent half the time talking about rails, and we talked about all the things in relationship to rail system in the United States. And I guess I want to review is that what I understand is that new urbanism is a way where we organize our towns in a way that is more compact and pedestrian friendly, and that in turn goes in hand in hand with developing a national rail system. Do you want to just start from there, Andy?
Sure, and you're exactly right. They do go hand in hand because a walkable community enables you to move around and go to services and restaurants and things like that without having to have a car. And then with the rail system connected to it, you're able to go longer distances to jobs and other things that may not be right in your immediate area. And so that sort of gives the two are complementary in that one gives you local access to things and the other gives you regional access. And so therefore, if you have both of those in place, you really don't need a car.
Last time you were speaking about getting the bigger picture thinking on all of these issues that we read on a day-to-day basis, the news. In fact, I was just reading the news today, or at least what's been happening the last week, is about rice and the lack of supply of rice. And what does that mean? How, you know, all of these the news, it really almost, if you connect the dots, it comes down to us using our cars.
Well, I mentioned this, I think, on your first show, that what it's going to come down to is that the food, if you try to use food to power our cars, we end up in competition with, you know, powering our car versus someone in another country eating. And, I mean, I'm actually amazed at how fast this is happening. I mean, it's like happening all over the world right now. Food prices are out of control, and a large part of that is because so much of it is being devoted to
biofuels,
and then the other part is just the rise in fuel costs because food production is so dependent on fuel for fertilizers and to run all the tractors and the processing and all that. So those are like two sides to the coin that are driving up fuel prices, and so, I mean, food prices. And so, here we are, it's exactly right. If you're going to drive a big gas-guzzling SUV and power with biofuels, someone in Africa or Haiti or some of these other places is going hungry. And that's, you know, I think that's getting down to, is that really what we want to do?
It comes down to that. And that is so staggering, and that is why I say the system is evil. And when we think about where other countries think of the United States people as evil, we think of a system as evil. And let me correct that, because you were saying about driving cars, and I just don't see people switching to another car. And if they do, there's still many other infrastructural changes that need to happen. And I was thinking about this and why people are not rushing out to drive more fuel-efficient car. And this is my theory, and maybe you have an opinion or reaction to what I was thinking about this theory, is that people think that buying a more fuel-efficient car is similar to rearranging chairs on the Titanic, where the problem is just so huge, and it's just going so crazily in the bad direction. What does it matter if I switch these little things, when in point of fact that it really has to come from you got to steer the entire Titanic around?
Oh, you're exactly right.
I was thinking about that. That must be it, because I can't think of something else.
And you got to think of this, too. The average person probably has a 4 or 5 year loan on their car. And in many cases, even if they want to get rid of their car, there's probably not a whole lot of buyers out there who want a big SUV right now. So, you know, I think a lot of people are actually stuck with it, you know, unless you just, you know, basically give it away.
I was thinking is that we are stuck.
We're definitely almost paralyzed.
We are stuck. And so I was thinking, why are we stuck? We have set up a system, or maybe we haven't set up the system. The system has set us up for something.
Well, there's definitely players behind it who have been for years making sure that policy continues in a certain direction. I mean, you know, the big oil companies, the big auto companies, the road builders, those are very powerful lobbies in this country. They probably have tens of thousands of lobbyists in Washington trying to just make sure everything stays in their favor. So the average person doesn't really have a whole lot of control about that. If you live in, let's say, Phoenix or Dallas or Los Angeles and you want to take a train, there's probably a good chance there isn't even one available. So you're stuck driving. You know, it's not a fault of the people so much as the controlling corporations have for at least 50 years have been directing policy towards more roads and away from trains. They actually went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Until now, because.
Well, now they're going to, you know, the politicians are going to have to actually come up with real solutions. They can't come up with any more of these, you know, talking and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. They're going to have to come up with real solutions real quick, because not just, you know, global warming and all that, but actually now the price of fuel is going out of control. And so it's affecting everybody. It's affecting, you know, your transportation, your food costs, your anything you're buying, your heating of your home, your air conditioning. I mean, it goes on and on and on, because oil is so integral to all those systems. So I think that there's going to be almost a revolution, and, you know, people are going to be demanding real solutions from the top for a change.
I was thinking of why we haven't said much before for the last 40 years, and I was reading this book called Collapse by Jared Diamond. One of the things that was said in one of the psychological principles was that when something happens, this is a little complex. Well, it's not really that complex, but for a person to be inconvenienced, each person gets inconvenienced a little, and a big company, the other side of it, wins out a lot. But because the inconvenience per person is very little, the little people, the individual person, is not going to say much.
Right.
And so it ends up, that concept actually ends up snowballing.
Well, now it's becoming a big thing for all the people. because, like I just said a minute ago, that, you know, the cost of their transportation has gone up 30%, the cost of their food is up 30%, their cost of buying any goods are up 30%. So all of a sudden, someone who's just making ends meet, which is probably more than half of America, is feeling a crunch every single week, and things keep going up. It's not stopping.
What happened? I haven't been keeping up that much with the 30% increase. What happened the last few weeks?
Well, I looked today. I think the price of a barrel of oil is already like 126 or somewhere around there, and that's almost doubled in just a year. I mean, that's phenomenal. That's affecting the price of airline tickets, the price of everything you buy. Every time you go to the store, every single thing across the board is more expensive because much of it is made from oil. The machines that produce it use oil. The trucks that deliver it use oil. You know, I mean, it's just everywhere. So I think that people in every part of our society are feeling a major squeeze right now that 2 years ago they really weren't feeling because it was creeping up slowly. Now it's creeping up rapidly.
So any economy that's based on any type of oil transportation that's based on oil or anything like that would be affected?
Oh, yeah, and America is probably the most dependent on oil in the entire world. So it's definitely going to affect our economy more than any other economy. And it's not because we're the biggest economy. It's because we are the most inefficient in the way we use oil. Our transportation is probably number one by far.
Our transportation infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, like you look at, compare us to Europe, who I think have a similar, if not higher, standard of living. They don't need to use barrels and barrels of oil just to move around because they have efficient electric trains. They have compact cities where they can walk. So it's a huge difference. You know, the average American probably uses 8 times more energy than the average European. And it's not that we're just wasteful and stupid. It's that we have evolved cities and transport systems that use huge amounts of oil, and they haven't. They've evolved transportation systems and cities that use very little oil. So it's a huge, you know, black and white comparison right there. You know, that Europe, and I'm thinking Western Europe, the most civilized part of the most advanced parts of Europe, they are living, I think, way better than we are because they're not stuck in traffic all the time. They're not feeling a constant squeeze of every month for money because of the rising prices. It's not so integral into every step of their daily life like it is here.
It makes me wonder about the basic psychological principle of the fish gets as big as the fishbowl.
Of the what? I'm sorry.
The fish gets as big as the fishbowl.
Right.
Where we have a lot of land in the United States and we feel like we have to use it all up.
Yeah.
Because we have it. And it makes me wonder about that. Because when I do my consultations, even about houses, when we have in a lot of ways, I see a house as a microcosm or as a macrocosm. Microcosm of the world, if we have a big house, we're just going to fill up everything just to fill up the house. And it's almost psychological, and it's similar to the United States and having that much land where it just makes me wonder if we would do just fine if we just had half the amount of land. But because we have so much, we feel like we just have to use it all up.
Well, and, I mean, if you look at the EU in comparison to the U.S., it's almost as much land. But they have not sprawled out and filled every inch of it like we try to do. They have much stricter land development codes that the cities just don't sprawl like they do here. I mean, you could look at an aerial photo of any American city, and you can see the historic core is a small little circle compared to the gigantic sprawl around it. It's like a donut with a little teeny hole in the middle and the massive, big, huge donut. If you look at European cities, you see the same historic core and just a little tiny bit of sprawl. You just don't see hundreds of miles of sprawl like here. So that's our problem. That is our wasteful part of our society. You know, like a person who lives in a historic core of, say, San Fran or Boston or Washington or New York uses probably one quarter or one tenth the amount of fuel of a person who lives 50 miles out in the suburbs in the same region. So it's a real difference there.
That's a good point. And we are talking about land development. We're getting into that with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org. That is www.newurbanism.org. And we'll be back. Welcome back. I am Emmy Louie. We're here with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org. We're talking about land development and comparing land development with the United States, land development with the one in Paris. And to add to that, when I went to Tokyo, I read up about Japan before I went there, and Japan has one of the most advanced ways of preserving their forests, and that they've left their forests intact. And my question for you, Andy, is do you know what is the, where did we go wrong, or what is that missing link between these places in Europe where they are respectful of their land development and are able to manage it and not sprawl out, and how Japan does it compared to what the United States has done?
Well, the United States, it probably comes down to that we have the most liberal land ownership rights laws, property rights, in that if you buy a piece of land, you know, even if it's 200 miles from a city out in the middle of nowhere, you have the right to develop it, and there's no controls on that or very few controls on that to stop you. And actually, counties and cities will actually build roads and sewers and power lines and all that to your land without even charging you for all the cost. So it's almost like runaway land development sprawl. There's not central government planning. There's not central government control over this kind of thing, whereas in many other countries there are. So that's probably one of our biggest problems. We've been sprawling this low-density, single-use type of development outwards from every city in the United States for more than 50 years. So to the point now where something like 70% of Americans live in sprawl and use huge amounts of energy just to move around, just to go shopping, to go to their job and all that. And that's a problem. That's a huge problem, because it's even hard to fix sprawl and hard to make it more efficient unless you just start infilling sort of dense little town centers throughout and link, you know, a rail line through it. But when you have 100 miles of sprawl in just this huge swath across the landscape, it's hard to even reconfigure that to make it more energy efficient. It's almost, you know, and it's funny now, it's not funny, but I mean, it's kind of bizarre now that this housing meltdown situation, the housing that has melted down the fastest and has dropped in value the fastest are the ones that are way out the furthest sprawl, which is the most inefficient of all the homes. So it's almost like the price of oil and the house meltdown are all sort of related and driving each other. And the housing that has dropped the least in value are the urban, walkable, mixed-use places that are much more fuel efficient to live in.
Yes, because they're more stable. They're in a stable community too.
And there's more people interested in living there. And, you know, as gas prices go up, all those people that live 100 miles out are rethinking their lifestyle. You know, think of the average couple. They each drive an SUV. They live in this big 3,000 or 4,000 square foot house way out in the suburbs. And each time the gas goes up and fuel oil goes up and all that, their monthly expenses just keep going up in huge jumps. And, you know, those are the ones who are like, wow, we need to rethink our lifestyle. We can't afford to keep.
There's two things that I thought about since you were talking the last few minutes. Number one has to do with park and rides, and number two has to do with minivans. Because I want to talk about Park and Ride and see if that is a good alternative or a good hybrid or a solution to our sprawling lifestyle. And then minivans. I remember even 20, 30 years ago when we had station wagons. I guess, is station wagons the same thing as a minivan, or...
Well, how
on earth did it convert from a station wagon to a minivan?
The station wagon and a minivan are similar, and that sort of evolved into the SUV, which, you know, the car companies actually were pretty sly in this, in that they were able to get around the fuel efficiency standards because they were not required on light trucks. And so SUVs are not considered the vehicle under those rules. They were considered a truck. So they exploited that loophole and advertised like crazy for 4 or 5 years and got half of America driving SUVs in a matter of, I mean, you can just remember back a certain, I don't remember how many years ago it was, maybe 6 or 8 years ago. No one was driving SUVs. Now half of America is. You know, all of a sudden, everyone has to have an SUV. It doesn't make any sense.
So what is the difference between a station wagon, minivan, and an SUV? I know you just said that SUVs are considered a truck.
They're on a different kind of chassis that's considered a truck chassis versus the minivan and the station wagon are car chassis. I mean,
so
it's kind of stupid.
Does the SUV use more gas than a minivan?
Being
stupid because I don't actually never had a minivan. But
I think a minivan is no different than a station wagon. It's just taller. You know, it's more boxy and it's taller, but they're still probably on the same kind of chassis. Whereas an SUV is a truck chassis, and that didn't fall under the same fuel economy standards and rules.
So I know this sounds really stupid, but what was going on behind those people who were thinking about these SUVs as being a light truck? I mean, and what were they thinking? I can't even go there.
Well, what happened was that back when we had the first fuel crisis in 1973, everybody started switching to small cars. And the auto companies make much lower profits on small cars than they do on big gas-guzzling cars, like big, you know, Cadillac Escalades and the Lincoln Town Car and all those.
They make much less money because of what?
Well, the sale price is smaller. You know, if a little Chevy Vega or remember the Ford Pinto, those probably only cost, $10,000-$15,000, whereas the big gas guzzling Lincoln Town Car probably cost $25,000 or $30,000. So there's more profit to be made on the big vehicles, and since everybody was turning to small vehicles, the auto companies their profits were shrinking, and so that's why they exploited this loophole of creating the SUV, because they cost $30,000-$50,000 for an SUV, and they went on this massive advertising campaign to get everybody driving, and it was super successful. Half of America or more are now driving SUVs,
and
their profits went back up from all the SUV sales. Well, now that's reversing because no one can afford the fuel. So now the auto companies are back in trouble again because, you know, the SUV sales are falling off and, you know, they haven't even, you look at General Motors, they had an electric car that was a fantastic car back in the mid or late 90s, and they pulled it off the market. When that probably today would be the hottest selling car in the world. And they pulled it off the market and keep advertising SUVs and Hummers, you know, when no one wants them.
What are they thinking right now?
I don't think they're paying attention. I mean, if you were GM chairman, wouldn't you get that electric car back out of the archives and mass produce that?
I have no idea. I just couldn't imagine even going there. That's why I'm asking you, like, what is going on in... Must be that... Is it because of profit and shareholders? Is that what it is?
Their profits are going down. So
think
at that point that, you know, the shareholders would all be mad because the stock keeps dropping and that, you know, they'd say, guys, you need to make a car that America wants, not keep making big SUVs and keep advertising to try to make America think that's what they want because it's not working.
Okay, let me see if I can answer this question about what I was saying, what was going on with their in these people's minds when they were creating these SUVs? Is it because that they were trying to make a profit for the shareholders? Is that why?
Of course, yes. That's why they went on this SUV kick, because it worked. I mean, their profits shot up, and they sold SUVs like crazy.
That's another evil system right there.
Well, I mean, they weren't thinking in terms of, you know, what's good for the world or what's good for the environment. They were just thinking in terms of what product can we mass produce and advertise like crazy and get everybody buying and make the most money.
So I can make the most money so I don't get fired.
Yeah.
Right, because I don't get fired as a CEO, because my job is to make money.
Make
for
money for the company.
And so that's why I'm saying the system, because it's not the CEO that's evil, it's the whole system when it's gone awry, and there's
what?
No check and balance on that.
And they say corporations are amoral. They're not immoral, they're just amoral. They just, you know, crank out products and try to make money. And it's, you know, in the end, there's no one really making judgment calls on, you know, like cigarette companies. I mean, you know, they're producing a product that clearly is deadly if you use it as directed. But they just keep cranking them out because they're making profits on it. I mean, and there's products that, and there's no real control over, you know, there's no judgment in America or probably anywhere in the world on products if they contribute to a better society or they cause problems for society.
Well, I mean, not to make an evil less than another evil, but cigarette smoking is almost less evil than sprawl, because cigarette smoking, you can just stop it tomorrow, or
right.
You can stop it in 30 days, whatever,
right.
You know, take these classes or whatever. With the sprawl, you can't stop it.
And you're sort of stuck with, I mean, we've been building sprawl for 60 years, that's trillions of dollars of investment in a form of, you know, sort of a form of development that has no future. That's pretty devastating when you think about that. I mean, we've been investing in this thing for a long time, you know, several generations, and it has no future because there's no more cheap oil, and that's what it was all based on.
So I wonder if some class action suit is going to come up.
Well, it happened with tobacco. I don't see why it can't happen with cars and, you know, a number of other products.
I know that's not up on the bulletin board to do, but it just popped in my brain right now. I just was wondering, because usually when there's a class action suit, that's when things change a lot.
Well, I hear that the lawyers who were behind the tobacco suits are now going after the food industry.
Well, they have to do something, right?
And then they need to go after the car industry and then the cell phone industry and, you know, go on down the line of all the products that are harmful to humans.
In that order, though. In that order, what you just said.
Yeah. I mean, for sure, the transportation and the cars is probably the biggest problem of all those, if you add them all up. Because of, you know, we're dependent on a system that, the fuel prices are out of control right now, and they're going to keep on going, and then there's probably going to be shortages, and then it's going to really cause problems for this country, because that's how we get our food, that's how people get to work. I mean, you know, I don't think anyone even realizes the problems that we face if we don't start revamping our systems now. And just, we can't just keep going on with business as usual, because we're going to be hitting a brick wall real quick.
So you said that the class action suits would be for tobacco, food, car, cell phone. What was the one right after car? You mentioned another one, I think. That's okay.
Yeah, I think it was cell phones after the cars.
Because of all of those, and you said this, you said that the car is the biggest problem because of the system, and I agree, because, look, if you say tobacco is bad for you, okay, you can try to quit for the next 30 days. If, you know, food, you can maybe go and, but then again, groceries are expensive.
But you can start growing your own food or, you know, small farms in and around cities.
Yeah,
that's solvable.
You can have a different lifestyle. You don't have to have cell phones. We never had it before.
Right.
You know, our grandparents never had it.
Right.
So these are lifestyle changes that can be, but the car, now that's another question.
Well, it's because it's so difficult because of what I just said, is that we've built all these miles and miles of sprawling suburbs that the only way you can get around is by a car. That's
okay,
a problem.
So where does the park and ride come in? Because I was thinking about the park and ride. what is New Urbanism's stand on park and ride?
Well, I mean, park and ride is a partial solution, but you have to have the rail systems in place that people can ride to.
Okay, yeah. So why don't we talk about that? We'll take a quick break, and we'll talk about park and rides when we come back. I'm here with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org. That's www.newurbanism.org, and we'll be back. Hello, I am Emmy Louie. You're listening to the Emmy Louie Show. We're back with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org, and we are moving into the topic about park and rides and how it's a semi-in-between solution. However, it still needs to be connected because it's a transportation network, and transportation is about moving a person from one place to another and connecting the dots. So what is the New Urbanism's views on park and rides?
Well, park and ride is definitely a partial solution, but to make it work, you have to have rail systems radiating out from the cities where the employment is, then people can drive from their sprawling neighborhoods to the nearest rail station and then switch, park their car, and hop on the train and ride into the city. Now, part of the problem with that is we don't have enough rail systems in place, and a lot of the employment centers are not in the cities. They're spread out all over the suburbs as well, because they sort of follow the homes as they grew all over the place. So, I mean, here in D.C. or maybe New York, San Francisco, Chicago, some of those cities, probably most of the employment centers are in the city, and so that's where most of the people are going. But in places like maybe Dallas or Los Angeles, they're scattered all over the region, and it's even hard to organize that with a rail system that people could actually drive to and then ride into, because the destinations are as diverse and spread out as the homes are.
Okay, so...
But let me just tell you this. I have a friend who lives in D.C., and he actually uses the park and ride. He lives probably 10 miles from one of the outer rail stations, and he said just in the last couple of weeks, he's noticed that he arrives to the parking lot about the same time each day, and each time gas goes up a little more, the space that he gets is further and further out to the perimeter of the lot. So each time gas goes up another, 20 cents or something, another 100 people decide to use the park and ride, and the lot gets more full and the trains get more full.
Okay. You're saying that people are priced out of their driving habits and then they use park and ride. What about something that's in between? Okay, and the only way I can phrase this is in a scenario that I can see around where I live, and I'm just asking this in a general question. Now, where I live, there are several universities and some major hospitals, and those are big employment centers. They're just big. They employ over thousands of people, each one, the universities. Mm-hmm. And there's been discussion about light rail, but that's probably not going to happen for another 5 to 10 years. Why? And then there's other nodes of activity, such as the shopping malls. There's a lot of people that go to the shopping malls and they park there. Why? And there's also smaller nodes where there's maybe a grocery store, like a big chain grocery store. Picture the scenario. Why can't I, in my suburb, drive to a major supermarket, park my car in front of that supermarket where the parking lot's empty 90% of the time, and then take a quick bus to the mall in a very easy way, and then maybe take another bus somewhere else?
Well, I think the problem is that no one's planning that right now. There's no county government. There's no planning department that's setting all this up. But I think that is the direction we're going to have to go. That's like the quick fix, is we have to start looking at regional transportation issues and start rethinking things. And that's probably the first step, is to set up some nodes. You know, if you have, like you said, you picked exactly right. You picked the major shopping malls, major universities, major employers, all those places are either big destinations or big potential exchange points of people where they can drive in from their sprawling subdivisions to those central places, and then those central places could have, they could start with a bus system that goes around hitting all those and collecting them together and then dropping them at either other major destinations or the downtown, if that's where the employment is. I think that's a good first step, but I think, mm-hmm. you know, that's going to have to evolve a lot further where, you know, it's still difficult because in the suburbs, so many things are so spread out that, you know, even if some, if a bus came and picked you up at the shopping center and you work at some office park 40 miles away and someone else works at a, you know, a university 30 miles in another direction, it still is a problem to drive all over the place, dropping people where they're going. I mean, because you're stuck in traffic, and that the beauty of rail systems is they're on their own guideway that's not ever stuck in traffic, so they can zip from, you know, high density node to high density node at 80 miles an hour without any delays, and you can really move thousands and thousands of people that way. Whereas buses are much more limited in the capacity of how many people. And I think that's the problem, is the numbers. If you look at any region, you might have several million people that are commuting to 50,000 different destinations. You know, to try to organize that with buses is almost a nightmare. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. You are connecting the dots and figuring out where it intersects, and in sprawling situations, there's too many intersections.
There's a million dots in a million different directions. That's the problem. And I mean, you can certainly look at even a sprawling region. You can go through there and evaluate the whole place and say, okay, give me the top 20 high-dense nodes. And, of course, you pick them, like major shopping, regional shopping malls, major universities, major employment centers, say where there's, you know, 5,000 employees or 10,000 employees. You could take a map and you could put red dots on all of those across the region, or pick the top 40 destinations, and then you begin to organize those along a rail system, and then you begin to shape a region and you start moving people out of cars. That's definitely what we're going to have to do. And I think this idea of, when you said light rail is 5 to 10 years away, I think that's going to have to change, because it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, China right now is building 8,000 miles of high-speed trains, you know, as fancy and as sophisticated as the TGVs in France, and they're doing it in 2 years. And we could do the same. We just need to get off our butts and do it and stop, you know, hem-hawing around and debating it and doing studies. We need to just get into gear.
So
you know what I'm saying? I mean, this country can move fast if we feel like we're in an emergency situation.
So,
if China can do it, we can certainly do it.
So you're saying that talking is not good at this point?
Well, I mean, it's a bunch of nonsense. They'll sit there and debate for 5 years about what's the route, and then they'll debate another 3 years of which train to use, and then they'll do some more studies.
Well, who are you talking about, debating and studies?
Well, all these government agencies who actually make the final decisions to build these rail systems.
And
I think they're doing it just to...
I mean, what you're saying, that China's going so fast and all.
China doesn't sit around and debate this stuff. They just say, okay, we're building it. And, I mean, they blast right through towns with this. I'm not saying that's a good idea, but... They, you know, I'm here in the D.C. area, and they have been debating this, extending the metro system to Dulles Airport. They've been debating it for 4 years now, and they're finally talking about doing it, and then it was off the table, and it's back on the table. I mean, we'll be lucky if 10 years from now that thing is open for service. And
what's
that's
going
just
on
a,
with that system, then?
That's just a, I'm guessing here, that's probably not even a 20-mile... simple metro rail system. It's not even a high-speed train like in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and here we are supposed to be the most powerful country, and we can do things. We can put a man on the moon in 8 years. You know, the fact that we can't build the rail systems we need in a couple of years, it's not that we can. It's just that there's no one really pushing to do it. We haven't said we're in an emergency situation. We need to do this. China, I think, they started building roads, and they were going to try to copy us, and they realized that there's no fuel to do that with. There's not enough oil for their whole society to be able to have cars, so they quickly just said, you know, let's go the route that we know we can do. Let's look at what France has done. And in 2 years, they're going to build 8,000 miles of rail, high-speed rail that'll do 200 miles an hour. I mean, that's phenomenal, and it can be done. I mean, you don't even need to invent anything. The technology all exists. They've been using it in Europe for 25 years. They've been using it in Japan for probably 40 years. So, you know, and you can call up these companies that manufacture these trains and order, I want 50 trains that do 200 miles an hour, and they start manufacturing them. I mean, it's not a big deal.
I noticed something about China, and this is a very broad stroke on how they make decisions. They do look at other countries as ways to model their own country.
Right.
Do we do that?
Well, I think we do, but then we've got so many special interests that just do everything they can to derail all those plans and just keep everything the way it is, because the way it is how they're making lots of money. That's the problem.
So it's the system, and I understand that there was some legislation about special interests.
Yeah, but that's like a, you know, Band-Aid. I heard something the other day. There's like 40,000 lobbyists in Washington, D.C., all they do all day long is sit around the senator's offices and the congressman's offices and make events and donate money to this, that, and the other. And their whole purpose is to just keep everything the way it is now, keep all the money flowing to the way it is now. There's no one really lobbying for changing our transportation. There's no one really lobbying for changing land development. And that's the problem. We can do it. We have the money. I mean, we could, if we have to switch gears overnight and just say, okay, we're going to stop building roads. We're going to put all the money into revamping the whole national rail system, and we could do it in less than 5 years. I guarantee we could if we felt that it was serious enough and we put all our effort into it and all the big companies jumped in and built what we needed. I mean, General Motors, back during, I think it was World War II, they shut down all their factories, stopped building cars, and they retooled and started building all the things they needed, equipment for the war. There's no reason why they can't do that today and start building rail systems. And, you know, Boeing and those companies could stop building planes and start building wind turbines. You know, there's no reason. And, you know, right away, crank out all the things that we need, the numbers of trains we need. The highway builders could build the rail systems, you know, really fast. It can be done. We have the power. We have the industrial might. We have the factories. We have the labor. We have the money. But we just, no one has decided this, and no one is pushing for this. That's the problem.
And that's where you are. You're pushing for this.
Well, I'm pushing for it, but, you know, I'm not that powerful. I'm not a big lobbyist in Washington. I don't have millions of dollars behind me.
Okay. So we're here with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org. And that's www.newurbanism.org. I'm Emmy Louie, and we will be back. Welcome back. I am Emmy Louie. We are talking about the whole system of sprawl and rail systems, how it connects with climate change and peak oil. And here we have with us is Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org. He has many exciting things for us in leading us into the right direction as far as how our country really needs to change our whole way of living as far as our infrastructure is concerned, as far as how our towns are organized. And so, Andy, you attended a conference in San Francisco a few weeks ago. What conference was that, and how did it go?
It was called the Eco City World Summit.
Ooh.
It was really a pretty spectacular conference. I think it wasn't a huge conference. They had maybe 700 or 800 people, but it was quite impressive because it was very diverse. There were the former mayor of Curitiba, Brazil, was there. He basically, in I think 4 years, helped reshape his whole city to be much more environmentally friendly, and he reshaped transportation and he spoke and presented, and the planning director from the city of Vancouver was there talking about how they're greening up their city and revamping all their systems and planning for an oil-constrained future. It was really a spectacular conference. I think you can go to the website and see, I'm not sure if all the presentations are going to be on there, but you can see some of the things and a lot of the people and all kinds of ideas. It was almost a collection of all the correct solutions in one place, presenting about, even the former governor of Maryland, Paris Glendening, was there. So it was a lot of pretty important people who have done a lot in their careers to make the cities and their state more green and using less energy and starting to redirect funding towards more sustainable solutions. So it was kind of an amazing collection of, like I was saying with somebody at the conference, I go, wow, all the solutions we need are right here at this conference, and all the people who know how to enact these solutions are here, and we just need to get it from here out into the mainstream and into government policy, and then we could really change a lot of things in the time we have to do it.
So that's called Eco City World Summit?
Yes. And I think if you just go on Google and search Eco City, or Eco Cities, plural, World Summit, the website should come right up. And you can read through all the presenters and the topics, and it's really good. And now they're planning another one. There's going to be one in, well, it's a different group. It's in China next month. A big development company in China, they had speakers there as well. And they're now inviting a lot of the speakers from that conference to China to speak there. And it's kind of amazing. China might actually be the leader in how to fix your country. They started following America and realized that wasn't going to work, so now they're going full speed ahead into high-speed rail systems throughout the country and eco-cities and environmental technologies, and you know, as fast as they do things, and you know, they have so much money because they've been a successful manufacturer of everything across the board for probably more than 15 years. So, you know, they'll probably come up with a lot of solutions and be, you know, sort of the model for a lot of the rest of the world to look at.
Well, I went to a United Nations Association conference, and I heard that a speaker was talking about, has to do with, was it iodine deficiency in the world, and that they were researching it in China, and that basically if the government in China does it, it affects the entire world just because of the numbers.
Yeah. And you think about just about everything manufactured nowadays is done in China. I mean, you look at almost any product you have in your house, probably 90% of it's manufactured in China. So, you know, they've got a huge influence, and if they start changing things and the products change, it will spread all over the world real quick, no doubt about it. And they can be a model, like with this, with building 8,000 miles, they're going to have more high-speed rail than any other country in the world in 2 or 3 years from now.
Yeah, and just by sheer size.
Well, by how many miles they're building. I mean, it'll be way more than France has, way more than Germany, way more than Japan. It's phenomenal.
Well, it's because of the size of the country, right?
In how many miles they're building in such a short time. I mean, it took France 25 years to build, you know, a third of that,
mm-hmm.
whereas China's doing, you know, they're going to have more than the whole rest of, probably almost more than the rest of the world in a couple of years. So they do things in a big way there. So that'll be a great model just to look at how efficient their economy will become once that's all in place. Because if you compare the energy use of a high-speed train per person, per passenger mile, it's probably 50 times less than by an airplane, which is how most of our movement takes place in America. That's beyond the driving distance. It's all by airplane. So it's, you know, 50 times more energy per passenger mile by air than it is by high-speed train. And so then, if they convert their whole economy over to high-speed trains, you know, their energy use will be, they'll still be able to move and have a thriving economy using very little energy, which is phenomenal when you think about it. You look at America, it's like our economy's crumbling because of we use so much fuel. And the fuel keeps going up, our economy crumbles more. So, you know, that's a pretty obvious solution to me, is we need to be doing the same thing China's doing.
Which comes back to what I was saying about Barack Obama, and I was watching the news and how he is compared with, I think, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt,
mm-hmm.
and being able to have some sweeping, if he was elected president, if Barack Obama was elected, was to have some sweeping changes, because we're at a time where we're very ready for that.
And we have to do it. I don't think we have too many options. Because if we don't, our economy is just going to keep shriveling. There's no question about it. I mean, we have to have it. And the biggest sweeping change that he needs to do, and I'm not positive he even is on this or knows about it, is transportation. By far, and you know, the most successful thing that he could do to fix the future of America would be to just a massive investment in a rail system like China's doing. You know, state to state to state, so you can move all around the United States quickly, easily. You can move food on these trains. You move people. You know, that will be what saves America, and hopefully that's the direction, if he becomes president, that he'll push. And he could. I mean, if he got in there and just said, okay, you know, this is an emergency situation, which it is, we're going to make a national rail plan, which is basically also a national defense plan, so then we're not so dependent on oil from the Middle East, which obviously that's not a good thing to be. You know, and just get the whole country on board and everyone motivated, and, you know, we'd go like crazy on down that path, we would see a huge difference in the next 5-10 years. So hopefully he's on that. I'm not positive he is, because I haven't really heard him say much about it. He talks about infrastructure investment, but I don't really hear much about what infrastructure he's talking about. Could mean more roads, which is just dig us deeper into our problems. So hopefully he's aware of these situation, or I mean, it's kind of obvious. You almost have to have your head in the sand to not realize that oil is a problem, and that American transportation is a problem, being so dependent on oil. It's almost like Bush said, America's addicted to oil.
Really?
Oh, he said that. I think it was in 2006. It was shocking. You know, the most profound thing he ever said in his entire presidency. And it's true. I mean, and you know, the only way, if you're addicted to something, you don't try to find more of it. You try to get off the addiction. And so, you know, he made that statement, but now everyone is still saying, oh, well, we need to drill in Alaska, and we need to drill here, there, and everywhere to find more. Well, that doesn't, if you're addicted to something, the solution is to try to break your addiction, not find a new supply.
Well, very good.
So let's hope whoever gets in there, let's hope it's Barack, and let's hope, you know, he takes us down a new path, because then we would really have a whole different future. If not, you know, I think we're just going to continue to be in wars, and our economy is going to continue to get worse, and people, you know, it's just a really dark way if we keep going down the same path we're on, versus if we change, we could have a really bright future.
You know, a lot of these things have been happening the last few years because of 9/11.
Right.
And maybe we can, the repercussions of all that, so.
Well, and in a way, it's a good thing that oil, the barrel of oil keeps going up, because it's a wake-up call. If we don't have a squeeze, then no one does anything.
We're out of time. Thank you so much, Andy.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Andy is from the newurbanism.org, and that's www.newurbanism.org. And I'm interested in the politics of it all, too, and how we make decisions. So thank you so much, Andy, and hopefully I'll talk to you next time.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.